Hi.
Would you like to introduce yourself with all your credits?
Not really.
Come on. This is.
Yeah, please.
You're Stanley Kubrick's granddaughter.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
And is it the same spelling?
It's not the same spelling. I wish though. In hotels, they're always like.
Is that how you say it?
Kubrick. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It's totally different spelling.
I thought it was the same spelling. It's
the dog's in the crate.
Yeah. Because it's completely different in spelling. Sorry. He was biting my face.
She was biting her face, sorry. Because you misgendered her. That's her problem.
That's fair. I deserve that.
Yeah, I agree. That's happening out in the world. I don't know if you've noticed, but you misgender somebody, they have the permission to bite your face. I just feel like you should have this cup. I just think that cup's cleaner. This one it's fine, but it's calcium on it from, I don't know, water.
Thank you. I appreciate the cleaner cup.
All right. Well, what, I just don't know I don't know your letters.
Oh, that's okay. I'm Dr. Sarah Kubrick.
Yeah, but I don't know PhD, so MD.
DR. It's actually a doctorate in psychotherapy science, so the letters are really long.
Okay.
It's like a European PhD-ish situation.
And the difference between psychotherapy science and just psychotherapy is?
It's just a research-based program. It's why it's science.
Very jealous. Yeah. I have to turn the fan off because it's making my eyes cry before I'm ready to cry.
Make you cry, don't worry, but we don't need the fan.
Yeah. Dude, my therapist is a psychotherapist who is Adler.
Great, we love it.
You like Adler?
Yeah.
Is Adler's whole thing about parents are bad?
I mean...
It seems to be that way.
Freud is about sex, Adler's like, parents suck.
Really?
Great summary.
Is it?
No.
No. Umbrella, really?
Yeah.
Because that's how Alan is very, like, your parents are bad.
Focusing on your parents a lot.
And you agree with this?
I don't practice from that modality.
What is your modality?
I'm an existential psychotherapist.
Oh, existential. Very cool.
Yeah.
Which
so
is...
I'm more like, it's your fault.
Yes, that is why I like you. I studied existential philosophy.
I know, it's really impressive.
In college. Yeah, I wasn't good at it. I was just very high. And I was super baked, which...
I feel like that's everyone studying existentialism at some point.
Well, you read Nietzsche and then all of a sudden you're like, I'm an existentialist.
Yeah.
You're because like, he says I have control over my life. Here's the issue.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to tell you.
Enlighten me.
Good word. Mm-hmm. Enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
Birth of existentialism? No. Way off.
I mean, I wouldn't connect. Yeah, keep going.
Not connected at all?
I know, I said I wouldn't connect the origin.
Enlightenment is like Kant.
Yeah. I mean, Kierkegaard is our start.
Kierkegaard is the start.
Yeah.
And then it moves into... What do you... Okay. Here's the question.
Let's save them.
I'm going to save my questions, and it's so nice that I can ask them because I'm on my own pod, so I'm allowed to ask these things. One, existentialism in relation to another thing that I believe that is clashing with my existentialism is no free will.
Ooh, yeah, that's a hot topic right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because of Sam Harris, I would
yes,
say,
exactly.
Who I worship.
Oh, okay.
I love him. Everybody hates him. I love him. I also do...
I do not hate. I just...
And who's the other guy, the old dude that he works with all the time? I forgot his name. Sapolsky. Mm. They are free will people. And
mm-hmm.
I've tried talking myself out of it, but it does... I do believe it. I do believe that there is no free will. I believe that there's choice in the moment, but I do believe that the choices are not up to you. Like, all of your genetics and predispositions has led you. Like, for example...
Mm-hmm.
Last night, when I was getting into an argument with a guy I was dating, I realized in the moment, I was like, I can't. I can feel that there wasn't any world in which this didn't happen. Like, there isn't an alternate reality in which I didn't stir the turd right now. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, everything that happened today leading up to now, my sleepiness level, the going to a, you know, going boxing, going to this party, like, everything led up to it, and then it came out of my mouth, and I was able to, like, stop shitting on myself for doing it, because I was like, it just was going to happen this way.
Yeah.
But ooh, that's tough.
I don't like that.
You don't like it.
No.
You think we all have free will, and there's all
yes,
choice.
Of course.
But what about the fact that if I say, like, you know, like, what about the fact that your genetics and all of your predispositions are the thing that's guiding you?
So existentialism also believes in limitations.
Okay.
It's not like we say you have unlimited freedom, because that would be dumb. It's inaccurate. So we're saying you have limitations, but you're free within your limitations. And your limitation and my limitation will be different. That can be background, that can be family, that can be genetics, whatever it is. But within the realm of limitations or the givens of life, there's possibility.
So would you call, for instance, I'm also in SLAA, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and basically everything that they say is everything that I'm hearing is avoid triggers, your triggers, right? That's always what it is. Your triggers are this, your triggers are that.
Mm-hmm.
But existentialism feels like it would be like, well, change your triggers, right? Change your, be Nietzsche.
Yeah, be Nietzsche.
And Ubermensch your way out of it.
Absolutely. No, I mean, triggers, I understand we have triggers. It's not like we say you don't have triggers. But to say that you don't have the capacity to heal or grow out of your triggers, or that even when you're triggered, you have to react rather than respond, is where we would disagree. So yes, maybe you're triggered, but just because you're triggered doesn't mean you need to yell, slam the door, or threaten to leave your boyfriend. You can be triggered, recognize the trigger, and still respond in a way that will align with the person you want to be or perceive yourself to be.
Right. I always call her the engineer.
The engineer.
The engineer is the Jordan that I want to be.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, and the engineer is like very, you know, what do you call the jumpsuit? Very sweet, but very rugged also, like a flower farmer. Very like thorns and
that.
Tough hands, but makes really beautiful things. That's like the person that I'm always thinking of when I'm like, what would she do right now?
Uh-huh.
But then something happens where I go, wah, and I'm like, time for the real Jordan to happen, and then I burn everything down. Here's the other question.
Yeah, why are they so different? Okay, keep
than
going.
This one?
Yeah.
Than actual Jordan? Actual Jordan is like, doesn't believe in anything having longevity, so mm-hmm. doesn't want...
I like that.
Yeah, wants everything to go away that isn't gonna stay. That's actual Jordan is just like, what is the point of doing this? I've been this way since I was like, when I was little, I asked my mom obsessively, and it really freaked her out because I was like 5. I was like, if we die, why are we doing any of this? Like, why am I going to go over to my friend's house if I'm just going to die someday? And she was like, you need to ask your father this,
yeah.
You know? But that, so I've always done that. So when I'm in a relationship, for example, I'm like, this is going to end, and I don't really want to, like, get going and get attached if it's going to end, so I'm going to blow it up.
So if something is permanent, do you assume it holds less value or no value at all just because it's, oh, sorry, if it's temporary?
Yeah, because the loss will be so big that I'm like, I don't want to do this at all. I'd rather do this now when I'm in this mode.
Okay.
Than when I'm in sensitive engineer mode. Because the engineer won't be able to handle it and it'll really hurt her.
She'll be sad. She'll be crying over her flowers.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I see. So you're trying to avoid loss by inflicting it.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
And you feel like you have no control over...
Right. I feel like I have no control over that. Yeah. Because I know it's not right. Logically and analytically, I understand that that's insane.
I mean...
But it doesn't. When I'm in it, I'm like... And also, the other thing is when I'm in it, I'm trying on the idea. Like, I'm like, does this feel good? It's over. And I'm like, that does kind of feel good. And then I roll with it. And then when push comes to shove and it actually would be time for it to end, I'm like, no. I didn't mean it.
Cool.
Yeah.
You feel liberated by the concept of loss, but when it's actually you're facing loss, you freak out, it's scary, it's hard, and you don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, you're flirting with loss, but it sounds a little reactive. I mean, again,
reactive.
I'm not your therapist.
How do you fix reactivity?
You take space. You know the Viktor Frankl, like the most famous quote of all time. It's like,
do you care if I vape in here?
No. Okay. It's your home. Do whatever you want. Yeah. You may vape. I think you just have to create space. I think the concept that we think we need to immediately respond to a stimuli, or that we need to come to some kind of conclusion or speak our truth at any time, is kind of absurd. I think knowing what you want to say, knowing how you're feeling before you speak, a lot of people will speak while processing.
I do that. I speak.
So they'll be like, they'll say all the things because they don't actually know how they're feeling. They're hoping by the end of their statement, they'll come to a conclusion. I think that can be really destructive and painful for the other individual. So I always, like, you know, think before speaking, know what your position is before speaking. It's really important to avoid unnecessary loss, and then to have a healthy relationship with the loss you decide to do, because then it's intentional and it's yours. But if you don't believe in free will, do you believe in determinism? So you're, this loss that you're experiencing or might be experiencing is just something that was destined for you?
I think that, I think whatever is going to happen is going to happen, and there's nothing I can do to change it. Not as in I can't make decisions to move it forward, but I do think that whatever the decisions I make aren't up to me, so I'm almost witnessing myself do things and trying to guide it. Like, trying to be like, if I'm educated on what my triggers are, if I'm educated mm-hmm. on how to be reactive, then I can easily guide it, but I'm trying, when I do something, instead of, because what I do is I do something and I go, you're crazy for doing that was insane, you're a bad person. Instead of doing that, I'm like, that's just what happened, and that is what was going to happen, even though you've been informed, even though you're in therapy, even though you're trying, that happened, and that's okay, and it would have happened. No, there is no alternate reality where you didn't do that. This
correct.
Is
correct. I agree with the fact there's no alternate reality. I agree with the fact that it's okay that you did it, even if you're not proud of it. I would push back in that it had to happen. Why did it have to happen?
Because it did happen. So it's not that it had to happen, but it's that...
It didn't.
There is no reality where it didn't happen. Or, like, that it's like a relinquishing of, like, guilt, almost being, like, everything that has culminated up to that moment led to that, and now I get to dictate what culminates up to the next moment, which I hope to change.
So I'm going to push a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay, you're releasing guilt by doing this relinquishing. Okay, right. But I also feel like you're avoiding responsibility.
I am avoiding responsibility. Will you grab that curtain behind you and pull it?
This one.
The green one.
This way.
So to block out the... Okay, cool. Yes.
As in, I think when people speak this way, and again, I think it's totally fine to have a different worldview than existentialism.
Yeah.
Probably be happier. And I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but I do find that a lot of people who gravitate towards that kind of theory or understanding of their behavior are just also trying to avoid responsibility.
Yeah.
In terms of, that means you weren't that responsible for it. And
right.
That is that why you can give yourself grace? Because you're like, I wasn't... If you're not free, you're not responsible. That's the correlation.
Right.
You're only responsible as you are free. And so if you don't believe you have any freedom, that means you don't really have any responsibility. It's a pretty sweet...
Well,
sweet
the thing is...
...base to sit in.
You have to have responsibility because the whatever your person is that culminated into that moment,
mm-hmm.
that still caused inflicted pain on somebody else. So you do have to take responsibility. So you can't
for
be like...
For others or for you?
For you. You do have to be like, you know, what I did wasn't okay, and the next time I'm not going to do that. But I don't think it's good to be like, I feel like, you can say it out loud to help somebody, but
yeah.
the being like, I should have done that differently is a moot point to me, because it's like, I will do that differently in the future now that I know that that didn't work. But being like, I shouldn't have, doesn't make sense, like, modus ponens
yeah,
style.
Yeah, there's no point.
Right, because you're just like, there is no should, there is no reality where that didn't occur, so why am I saying... It should have been different.
But I also feel a lot of people conflate responsibility and blame. It's like,
yes.
Should have. It's like the pointing fingers. And I don't think responsibility is about blame. It's about ownership. I think
yeah.
It's an incredibly empowering concept of like, I can own my life and I can do what I want to. And what I have done was also a byproduct of my decisions. And maybe I don't like them, but I can own them. And
right.
I think there's something really... powerful about that position. So for me, I always want people to differentiate between blame and responsibility.
Right, and blaming themselves.
Blaming themselves, yeah.
So the responsibility, the thing about the responsibility that the, like, when I take responsibility and I go, I wish I had done that differently, or this is what I did that was not okay. When the words then leave my mouth and next time I won't do that,
mm-hmm.
That's where it gets tricky for me. Because it's one thing to be like, last night I got super overwhelmed and I didn't really know how to process the way that I was feeling. So I told you that I wanted to end it, and it must have felt like I was testing you, but I wasn't testing you, I was just
yeah.
processing out loud. And then another breakup. My friend is going through a breakup and calling me every day, poor thing. It's a good breakup. But,
all my friends went through a breakup in the last 6 months. Like, literally everyone I know.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
But it's... But then when I then say, and the next time it'll be different, that...
Does it feel like a lie?
It feels like a lie, because I don't know.
You don't know, so I'm not really sure you should be saying that.
Okay.
You can say, I will try not to do this again, or I see why this is problematic, and I don't really want to contribute that way to this relationship, so I will try to catch myself before I do that.
And you are in a relationship.
Correct.
And you're on the road all the time.
Correct.
And I'm on the road all the time.
Mm-hmm. Cute.
And, yeah, it sucks. And
it sucks so much.
It's really fucked up.
Yeah.
So here's the thing that happens to me. I have 3 days back home mm-hmm. where I am doing this, mm-hmm. doing the dog mm-hmm. to the park, doing the other podcast I have, sleeping.
Yeah.
Can you believe it?
Great.
Congrats. Trying to work out, if you can believe that.
Mm-hmm.
Eating bathing. Chicken.
Ooh. Okay.
A lot of chicken I'm eating. And then all of a sudden it's time for time in a relationship. And I'm tired. Mm-hmm. And I don't. And I've put all my effort into being on stage or, you know, on
engaging
whatever.
Engaging with people, yeah.
Yeah. So then I'm like, I don't. The whole thing is like the person that you're getting mm-hmm. is sleepy and kind of recharging.
Yeah.
Which is not a person that I'm proud of. Mm-hmm. So then it comes down to, of course, like, you make time for each other, right? And that sucks, because then you have the one day a month that you've made time, and mm-hmm. that's too much pressure.
Mm-hmm. You have to make it perfect.
You have to make it perfect.
Yeah.
How do you manage this?
I see my partner all the time, because we travel a lot. So that's okay. The difference.
Like on vacation or to
No. Like when we, because we travel most of the year for his work or my work, and we take turns. And sometimes we're apart, like right now. But we will try to actually be in the physical place like 9 months a year, traveling together. So the coordination of that is pretty wild. But we've done this for like years and years.
How many years have you guys been?
8.
8 years.
We've traveled pretty much the entire time. Or done like 4 months here for his grad school and 4 months here for book launch. And I lived in the Middle East because of his work for 2 years. And so we've done.
You lived in the Middle East?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Jordan.
You lived in Jordan?
Yeah.
What's his work?
I'll tell you later.
You lived there for 2 years?
I did. Maybe 2.5. And I lived in Tunisia for a while. No, embarrassingly. I mean, I know, like, the basics. Oh. It's a really incredibly difficult language. And all my friends there are lovely and speak English. And so they humor me. And that's how I communicate.
And what did you do all day while he was working and you were in Jordan?
I was completing my doctorate. I was doing research. I was working.
Oh, great. You're busy.
I had my
whole
life.
It's good that you're in a secluded desert.
Great that I was in a secluded desert. I mean, I had my own life, but I had to go, okay, I am in this geographical location. It wasn't my selection, per se. Like, it wasn't advantageous for my work, but it was for his. So I was like, great. So it's like, how do I have a life that I won't resent him for here and make sure that I like it and I still feel like a fulfilled human being? And so it's things like that that I'm like, okay, I'm taking responsibility for this because I agreed to this partnership. I agreed to the move. Now, sitting here, being unhappy, bitching, that's not part of the deal. So it's like, now I have to take responsibility for the choices I made and make sure that I enjoy it. And again, it's not like it was difficult. I have great friends there. I enjoyed living there. It was really fun. But, you know, again, I was away from my family, my friends, so there were sacrifices that came with something like that.
Yeah, and so you guys go, you travel around together, mm-hmm. and it's an arrangement. It's like something where it's like, I've made this decision, I've signed on to this.
Correct.
And I'm going to, be my word that I'm not going to guff about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's not an option for us. You can't really travel on the road with your, I mean, you can, but it's...
Yeah, it's much worse for you. I can't even imagine that pressure. I mean, I guess it's maybe similar to when you don't see your partner for a long time and you're like, let's make sure. Or it's like, we only have 3 weeks and then we're apart again. So it's like, make sure these 3 weeks are really great. But I think they need to understand that you're recharging. So there has to be grace from their perspective. And then also you have to take responsibility for the fact you chose to be in a relationship when you don't have time or energy for it, if that's the case.
It does feel that way. It does feel like I chose to be in a relationship when I don't have time or energy for it.
And in which case, you know, someone might say you shouldn't be.
Yeah.
But if you want to be, then that's fully on you. It's, you know, and giving someone scraps, I don't think would feel good for you nor for them. Unless you're both like, hey, we're giving each other the bare minimum, but we still feel like the output is worth it. So great. Just making it realistic.
Yes. Yes. I don't know. But then no comedian can really be in a relationship because we're always on the road.
Yeah. It's a very, from what I hear, intense lifestyle. I'm not really sure how you cultivate healthy relationships or maintain them.
Yeah, one of my friends is dating a therapist, and it still is off the rails. Because there's also the incestuous relationship amongst comics.
Yeah.
Where you're so close with all these people because you've traveled with them, you've worked with them, you're in the same, you know. So there's all of this bizarre sensation of infidelity because you're such a tight-knit group. That especially if somebody's dating somebody who's not a comic, it's a nightmare for them.
Because, do you guys usually date each other?
I do. I date comics.
Oh.
I can't not date it. I can't. I've tried. It's awful. They don't understand. And they go wake up at 9 and go to bed at 10, you know what I mean?
Or you're like, gross.
I just can't. I'll never see you. I wake up at 1, you know, and go to bed at 4. So it's, yeah, you can't. I've dated a musician and that was okay.
Yeah, because similar lifestyle.
Yeah, but even that is like, then they better be a working musician, which is way harder for being a working comic. Because even if you're not a working, even if you're not a road comic.
Yeah.
You're still getting up every night, even if you suck, you're doing mics, or if you don't suck, you're doing produce shows, and if you are good, then you're traveling. So, but with musicians, they're like...
So where do you travel? If you travel 4 days a week, is that what you said?
I mean, yeah, I travel Thursday, usually get back Sunday, or this one I'm getting back Monday. But, yeah.
You shouldn't be so successful. You shouldn't be so good at your job.
I know that it's, and I got the dog because I was like, I can't, something has to be consistent here. This is crazy.
Oh yeah, that makes sense.
Every hotel.
I know. Yeah. That's the thing. It's like the hotels, the Airbnbs, the like, do you have something that you take with you to make it feel the like dog. The dog?
Yeah.
Smart.
She comes everywhere.
She travels.
Oh yeah, yeah. She travels. Oh. Yeah. She's being very good right now.
So I bring a candle, so I feel like we're really? Not in the same. Like I'll bring something. I'll bring like a little box. I'll put it on my nightstand. I'll do like make it feel unpack a certain way just to make it feel more like home.
That's good. I wreak havoc in my. We trash hotel rooms together and play in them and get protein powder and dog food everywhere and then leave a big tip and leave, and then we come back here where I try and make it okay.
The big tip and leave. Oh my god, you're a nightmare.
Yeah, totally.
In the sweetest way.
Yeah, no. Like, because I'm like, if we're on the road, we're just going to make this a party. And then we just play, I whip the ball around the hotel room for her and we explore every city together, which is great.
That's so cute.
It's really cute. It's the best. She rules. And she's very good at flying. And she's very good at airports. But yeah, it does make it so, it also makes it so there is a sense of like, you're a unit. You're like this independent unit and you're moving around and you're getting up on stage and being like, hi, I'm a unit. This is the unit I'm representing.
Yeah.
And then you go back home and somebody's like, hi, how are you? And you're like, I'm done talking about how I'm done representing myself. I don't want to represent myself anymore. I just want to watch a movie. And then you're like, who are they dating? Just somebody who's watching a movie? That sucks, you know?
A comedian that's watching a movie.
A comedian that's watching a movie, yeah.
That's your type. Now we know.
Yeah, totally.
No, it's true, but I think anything as a therapist, if I have, you know, I don't know, back-to-back sessions, I had to tell my partner, I was like, I need you not to talk to me for like an hour or two after, if I have a long day of sessions and meetings, because I cannot, like, I need to process everything that's happened, I need to make sure I'm, like, taking care of myself, I'm absolutely exhausted being an active listener and investing, and it's such a cool job, but it takes a lot from you, and so being like, I don't want to hear about your day or your life or your problem this very moment. At first was like, wow, I'm a terrible human being. But then I'd be like, no, I just need like an hour of no one talking to me. And that's the same if I'm like with my sister and traveling. They just know after I'm done a really long day, you just don't talk to me.
Yeah.
And then I'll come back when I'm ready and more present. And that way I am not starting arguments. We're not having half-assed conversations. We're not contributing to like miscommunication. It's just setting those boundaries was so important for me. But some people be like, I can't believe they put up with that. Like, me not wanting to talk to them immediately. Like, I don't think that's a hard ask. But, you know, some people would be really offended and wouldn't want that.
8 years together, this, and you broke off an engagement, and now you're 8 years in with somebody else.
No, I got divorced.
You got divorced.
Yeah. Wow, crazy. You're really... Yeah, I got divorced.
You got divorced.
Correct.
A long time ago. You were very young.
That's very young. Correct.
And then the... And then you see... You've been seeing clients... No, you got the PhD with this guy. You were with him.
I mean, I saw clients before I got my PhD. I saw clients after my master's.
So, and that was... And then you... Were you... Did you switch to psychoanalysis after the PhD, or were you kind of just...
So, I did... counseling of psych as a master's, and then I was being trained at the same time in like existential analysis, which is like a specialization, and then for my PhD I did psychotherapy, specifically a program in psychotherapy, a doctorate in psychotherapy.
Are you doing couch or are you doing face-to-face?
I'm doing virtual.
You're doing virtual?
Yeah. I've always done virtual, though. Like, when I worked as an intern, practicum, all that stuff, I did face-to-face. And then since my career started, I was traveling. I was actually moving to Jordan. And so then I was like, how do I do this? And I've done virtual for a really long time.
With a bunch of people throughout the day?
Yeah.
For an hour or for 53 minutes? Mine is like 53 minutes or something.
Mine's 75 for the most part.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, I do long sessions because I just think they're more effective for a lot of clients. It depends. I'll determine depending on, like, how they process, how quickly they... It's like a U shape. It's like you start, you dive, but you have to bring them back up. And so how quickly they can dive and come back up is what determines if it's, like, a 50-minute or a 75-minute session for me.
In one session is the U shape.
Correct.
And how do you get them to dive if they're not going to dive, if they aren't diveable?
I mean, if they're not diveable, I'm not going to stick
their head under it. Because it's once a week, right?
Yeah, it's once a week. I have clients who will see me multiple times a week, depending.
Jesus.
What?
That's a lot. Multiple times a week?
Yeah. If they're going through something, it's a crisis, absolutely. I mean, Freud used to see his patients, I think, 5-6 times a week.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the psychoanalysis way of like...
But isn't there a certain point where you're like, this is a navel-gazy, like where somebody's just looking in the rearview mirror too much?
That's if all your therapy is focused on your past, yeah. A lot of therapies don't function that way.
Your therapy doesn't function that way.
I mean, I obviously care about what has happened to you, what has informed you, what has shaped you. But you can't change your past. So we're going to understand it. We're going to understand what meaning you attribute to it. How it's, you know, informing your decisions right now, but then we're gonna chill with it. We're gonna let it go. We're gonna go, okay.
What about the fact that, you know how the point of therapy is to get everybody to a place where they, like, love themselves, basically? Or they...
No.
Not love themselves, accept themselves?
Sure, yeah. Or respect.
Respect themselves.
I would say that's my favorite word. It's like, I don't really need you to like yourself or love yourself, but the bare minimum is like, how about you respect yourself?
And what if they're not respectable people?
Then you change that. Okay. That's a great question, because some people, you shouldn't accept who you are right now, and you shouldn't embrace your ways.
Yeah.
And some people, you know, it's like, we love to give diagnoses, and this drives me off the wall. It's like, he's a narcissist. It's like, no, he's just an asshole. Like, some people just, it's like...
Or he just told you why he doesn't want to be with you, which makes you think he's a narcissist.
Exactly. It's just like, let's chill.
Yeah.
And there's definitely behaviors we shouldn't be accepting about ourselves in terms of, like, you don't need to blame or shame yourself, but you don't need to be like, this is who I am, if it's something you can change.
Right. And I think that's the problem with the, what do you call the type of therapy that's, you know, the bite-sized... What is that called? Packaged therapy, where everybody's just like, you need to accept yourself and love yourself. And that's always been my issue with it.
I don't know what specific modality, but that, I mean, you know, that's how therapy comes off a lot of the times. And it's very, I think sometimes, especially the mental health conversation and what it is now, maybe not so much in an actual clinical setting, enables really crappy behaviors.
Yeah.
I think therapists are too scared to call things out or to... be honest or to allow their client to be uncomfortable during the session.
So you're kind of a bitch.
Oh, absolutely.
You're a bitch. People say it.
No. I love my clients. I would say my clients and I are super tight. And we have a really safe relationship.
Okay.
But will I sit there and watch you set yourself on fire and be like, how does that make you feel? And like, just love yourself through it. No, of course not. I'm going to like, pour some water on you and be like, okay, let's stop, take away those matches. Like,
yeah.
I very much, my point, my goal is never to have my client like me. My goal is to help you. And so they do like me, I think.
Yeah.
Watch, like, my client, like, nah, in the comment section.
Yeah.
But it's not like I'm not trying to be best friends with you. I'm not trying to win, like, a contest. I'm not trying to, like, make you feel good about everything. I'm hoping that you'll see the truth of your reality, that you'll take responsibility, and that you will hopefully start having a life you actually want to have. But to do all those three things, they're really uncomfortable. So, you know,
they're very uncomfortable. You posted this today. Do you remember what it was?
Today, about don't form attachments with people, you know, you'll have to detach from, or something like that.
Yeah.
It was better when it was written.
Yeah, don't form attachments with people you know.
You know you'll have to detach from. Okay. Yeah.
But how are you supposed to know that? I mean, how are you supposed to...
Oh, I love this. Oh, how would I know? You would know. If there's someone who you're like, I'm not going to have a future with this person, look at these patterns. This is like... dumpster fire.
But everybody thinks the patterns will change, just like they believe their own patterns will change.
That's a little of cognitive... I mean, I think that's people lying to themselves. I think sometimes we do know when things are not going to work out. We don't want to admit it, but we do know it. On some level, we're aware of the fact that that's not going to work. And yet, or we go, okay, we've been on a date with this person, and there's so many red flags. Like, so many. But I'm just going to try a couple more times. Maybe I'm not fully seeing them. And so often I'll say, fine, but make sure you're not building crazy attachment intimacy during these next couple dates. Maybe don't talk about the deepest, darkest secret. Don't talk about your childhood trauma. Maybe don't have sex. Whatever it is that makes you feel intimate with someone, until you determine they're worthy of that intimacy. Otherwise, you have the red flags, you build deeper intimacy, and then you're going to have to step back, and that's going to be so much harder.
So you think me, who's gotten broken up with 11 times, and now is in it where it's like we're working on it, we're going to, you know, we're talking to people, we're seeing people for help.
Great.
Yes, but there is always a part of me in every relationship where I'm like, this isn't, nothing works out. What is working out?
But I think that's, first of all, a great question. So unless you want to get married, have children, that's your definition of working out, and which is not for a lot of people nowadays. It's like, what is working out?
Yeah.
What does that mean? So I think you have to define that for yourself. No one can define it for you. But at the same time, if you're going to think that way, you're going to have that result. It's like the self-fulfilling prophecy. And that also sounds like something that's a little different to me. That's maybe that's not someone who believes that things can work out and then senses it won't. That's just someone who is trying to protect themselves and has a particular worldview or a particular belief that's like, this is not going to work out. So for you, I would say this would be more difficult to discern. But for someone who is like, they've had relationships they really liked or things have worked out in the past, and now all of a sudden they feel like, hey, I'm really unhappy and I know I should break up with this person, but I'm not. And I know I shouldn't continue seeing them, but I'm bored or I'm lonely, so I'm going to. It's like they're making it so much harder to make the right decision down the road. So that's what I meant by that. And yeah, my posts are a really good indication of how I function in therapy.
Yes. It's very straightforward and very... I'm all about the lack
loving.
Of... I don't... It is loving.
It's loving.
Sometimes. Sometimes it's not loving. And I'm like, you're talking to me and you're very mean.
You know, when I met you, I was like, I think this girl thinks I'm crazy. I don't think she likes me. And then you followed me back and I was like, shocked. I was honored. But I was like, oh, I thought you were like, this girl's so boring. Why is she even here?
Really? No, I thought you were so cool.
Oh, thanks.
No, I'm really all about...
Now I believe that because I'm sitting on your... fucking couch.
Yeah.
But like, I was like, oh yeah, she thinks I'm like unhinged. That's cool.
No way. No, I thought you thought I was unhinged. I was wearing like somebody else, a man's weird shirt.
That.
Yeah.
I don't know who that grossed out more, me or Rick, but.
Rick. 100% Rick.
I know, but I'm pretty bad.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's the one thing. Yeah.
I have OCD, but it's about other people contaminating me with their personalities and not about contaminating. I always worry that, like, if somebody's like,
more dangerous. Personality is way more dangerous than like a shirt.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm always worried I'll start talking like somebody I hate or that they'll, you know, I'll be influenced by somebody in a bad way. I'm always worried about that. But yeah, I think, no, I thought you had your head on straight and mine was rolling around on the ground. That's what I felt.
I had a migraine. I had such a bad migraine that I throw up when I got home. Like, I was dying the whole time we were talking. I have zero recollection of that conversation. That's why when you texted me, and you're like, yeah, I was listening to your advice. And I was like, I literally do not know what I said. I had to watch it.
I mean, the boundary advice that was heavy, I think, on that episode, which I've gotten better at, but that's, like, one of the hardest things. Even my mom was pressuring me to go to the Springsteen concert, and I couldn't go. And, I mean, it took me a full day to tell her I couldn't go, because I just was like, what if she hates me for it? What if something happens to her and we leave on a note where I'm saying no to going to this thing? And, like, I always have this, I can never be like, I'm tired, I need to go to bed. Like, if somebody's trying to talk to me, I will just stay, and I will suffer through it, and I will make myself do it.
I'll be like, I'm going to bed, it's 9.
That's great.
Lock up when you leave. Like, wow. I'll let people stay in my house, and I'll just be like, see you later.
Because you have self-respect.
No, because I'm uncool, and everyone knows that, and I value sleep over all else. Yeah. Literally nothing in my life is more important, and so I'm just like, nah, peace. That's not really a boundary. But I was thinking, like, there's some stupid shit that sometimes I can't say no to. Like, it's like friends that I'm making plans, and it's like, maybe I want to hang out with this friend and not that friend. It's like elementary school.
Yeah.
And I have to remember, like, Sarah, you're an adult.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Just be like, hey, actually, I'm going to hang out with so-and-so today. See you another time. But no.
I know. It's crazy. I don't know what we worry about. I mean, my friend the other day was like, I'm really sorry I can't meet you. I have to do taxes. And I was like, totally
you should have been
fine.
Really,
yeah, it was like,
you should have been like, how dare you?
But I knew the feeling he felt. Like, I'm so sorry. I'm such an idiot. I have to do my taxes. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah, it's just scarcity mentality. It's relentless scarcity mentality that if you say no to them once, then they'll never come back. It's the same in the relationship. If I leave this weekend and things aren't good, then when I get back, it'll be gone. It's all, which is being raised without somebody being, you know, if you never had a parent being like, I don't care if you shit on the floor. I am your parent. I love you.
Yeah.
Right? If they're just like, if you shit on
the best parents.
You're the best parents.
I know. I feel bad. I feel like I'm the anomaly. I had the best parents.
I have.
That was them.
A really powerful, incredibly intelligent, and narcissistic mother who's very like.
Ooh, the combo.
Yeah. She's very magnetic, and she's also like, why the fuck did I have children? I could have been huge. And my dad was like a love addict and was just constantly wanting love really bad, and my mom left him, and he was really devastated, and he got really angry, so I'm always looking for the narcissist, but I am also very much the, like, please love me, I have to trick you into loving me by being a different person than I am, constantly.
Totally, and I even think people with, you know, healthy, and I'll say, obviously, no one has a perfect childhood,
yeah.
But healthy, like, that's just our, that's most people's impulses, like, please love me.
Yeah.
But I think where the narrative gets warped is the fact that we don't think anyone could possibly love us for us. That's
right.
Such a fascinating thing that I see all the time. And I do think, like, a healthier upbringing obviously assists.
Yeah.
But
because
everyone,
you have a baseline of
you have
that
a baseline.
Person loved me. Yeah.
Yeah, that person tolerated, loved me.
Yeah.
But as you grow older, it's like how... And I think it goes from, if I can't like it myself, how would you possibly like it? If I don't see value in myself, how would you possibly see value in that? I think it really comes with how we feel about who we are.
Yes, totally. And, yeah, I mean, I also think that it's how we see ourselves, but it's also the dissonance between the person I want to be is so different than the person that I am. That you forget that the person that you are is actually a good, pretty good.
Pretty good.
You know, you're like, you have this thing that you want to get to. It's like when you see a picture of yourself and you look hideous.
Yeah.
And you're like, I thought I looked different, and everybody knows that I look like that.
No, I hate that. When you see, like, recordings, even podcasts, sometimes you're like, what the hell?
What
was
How
that?
Does anybody
accept
me into their home? Yeah, totally.
Sometimes
it's
I'm
crazy.
Like, can you not post that?
Yeah.
Thanks.
I know, it's crazy. And then you do that, and then there's the shame thing, you walk around. It's like if I eat bad, all of a sudden I'm fighting with everybody. It's like,
yeah,
you know?
But also, should our future self, and there's so much like, your future self, your true self, your best self... all slightly problematic, but should it be that different than who you are? Like, it can't be a completely different person. It can be a different version of you, though. And I think sometimes when we idolize this future self, it's like, someone that's not, it's like, I will enjoy hiking. I will, yeah. It's like, I fucking hate hiking. I'm not going to, all of a sudden, my future self is not going to like hiking. That's just not a thing. But we will do things where it's like, now we have a completely different personality and set of preferences. It's like, I still think the future self has to be founded on some foundation of like reality and who you are in the current moment.
Yeah.
And how you want to develop that version. But I see people do, like, dear future self, I will want to do a marathon, and I'm going to have a completely different relationship. It's like, okay, let's... I think when you can't connect the two, maybe who you're trying to become is not actually authentic.
Right. All I want is my future self to not threaten people. The threat is my big issue.
It's what is she? Give me a picture. 5 years from now. Your future self 5 years from now. What's she like? Who would you want her to be like? This is not therapy. This is just fun. I do this to my friends all the time.
Who would I want her to be like? I would want her to be... that's the problem. On stage, there's like an anger. There's a little bit of a critical analysis thing. There's a little bit of a bite. But who I want to be is somebody who's sweet. Right?
Great.
So those things are hard for me to bridge because it is, I guess it's a, I want to be lucid. I want to be lucid and not say things I don't mean. I want it to be somebody who is like not falling prey to every single reaction and whim, which means if somebody in the audience is being a cunt, I can be like, you're being a cunt. And if somebody's being a sweetie pie, I can be like, you're really sweet, you know?
What do you do now?
I say you're a cunt. But I don't say you're sweet. You know what I mean?
I see.
So I would like to be able to, yeah.
And I want to come to your show and say some outrageous things.
I mean, I had a cunt last week that tried to storm the stage. It was crazy. She was just a dumb bitch. And she was such a stupid slut. I hated her. She was a 27-year-old wearing no clothes. And she was talking to this guy. And she was, like, her head's right there facing him. And she's like, ah, ha, ha. And I was like, hey, what are you talking about? I'm not going to start the show until you tell us what you're talking about. And she goes, I want to go to a hot tub. So then I roasted her and I asked her about her. I was like, you're not very close with your family.
Oh, no.
Because I was saying I'm not, because we both were getting back into relationships over and over again, I found out. And then I asked her about her father and she shut down, went into the bathroom and started sobbing. I asked her, I was like, are you close with your dad? And then she turned and went to the bathroom and was like, and then she tried to storm the stage. Because I think in the bathroom, I was like, all right, maybe her dad raped her, whatever. It's still a show that you all paid for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even if he did. I just said father, and that's, I'm supposed to know that's her trigger word. No, I mean, so I was saying that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then
other... It's also a comedy show. Like, you guys provoke. That's part of it. That's the entire, at least to me, when people get offended at comedy shows, I'm always super shocked because I'm like... That's what I expect. Like, I want to be uncomfortable and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you want people to be uncomfortable in their sessions.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's not my, like, goal. But yeah, I think in discomfort is where we grow. We don't grow in comfort. Nothing changes when we're comfortable. People don't wake up one morning and go, I have a perfect life. How can I be better? It's not a thing.
Most people come to you to fix relationships, I imagine.
Yeah, or that's the presenting problem, meaning that's what they think they need.
And that happens a lot because when you're faced with another person, it brings up all the worst parts of yourself because they're scared of abandonment.
Oh, yeah, or because that's, like, the one thing you think will make your life better. It's like, well, if only I had a happy relationship, if only I can make my marriage work, then everything else will fall into place.
Have you ended marriages? Or advocated?
Except my own?
Yeah.
No. I mean, I never advocate, God.
You can't advocate.
No, I don't give advice. I don't tell you exactly what to do. I don't make choices for you at all. I just present them and help you figure out what you want. I think relationships have ended for my clients as they were my clients.
Yeah.
But I would like to think that that was their free will.
Yes, which they don't have.
Which... Wow, we're never going to agree on this.
I know, it's hard.
I'd have to change. I would have to quit. As a therapist, how could you possibly believe in no free will?
Because you believe that you can, it's the monkey riding the elephant. Like, the monkey you can give a book to, and the monkey will try and guide the elephant. But for the most part, the elephant is moving at its own pace. But you can do the best you can.
So what's the point of my job, then?
The point of your job is to try and educate the
monkey
so
that he can be disillusioned and believe, or like believe.
So that when he knocks into something, at least the monkey can be like, I'm an elephant, I'm sorry for doing that. You know what I mean? And try and steer it. But it is tough to steer. It's why, it's like you didn't, if it's like why the person who shoots somebody, you if you had lived every moment of them, of their life, you would have shot the person too. Which is why I don't believe, I think jail is like insane. I think it's crazy. Yeah, I know, it's crazy. The jail thing is one of those things that is in the world that nobody agrees with me on this, but I think jail is a crazy thing that we do. Like, cognitively, I'm like, it feels like quartering. Like it feels so archaic. That somebody does a bad thing and you put them in a cage with a bunch of other people who are bad.
What else are you supposed to do? Let them do it again?
I think you're supposed to give them, like, recovery.
Sure. You don't have money for that. But yes, ideally, I would agree.
Right.
You would do, like, rehab programs or
yes, but education. But we have so much money for that. We just spend it in the wrong place. But the prison system does cost a lot of money. I mean, we're just holding a zoo of people. It's very weird to take. That's very inhumane,
I will say. However, some of the things they've done were incredibly inhumane. But yes.
But, like, I think that if we accept the no free will thing, like, I think if you get to a place where you go, like, for instance, my sister, she was 15, brutally raped by a man. Older.
Oh my God.
Yeah, brutally. So forever I was like, jail is great. And then I thought about it after the free will stuff, and I was like, everything that led him up to that moment led him to there. Whether it was his mom, whether it was somebody raping him, whether it was all these things. And then we put him in jail. And there's no redemption for him. There's no growth. He's just in jail for a life that he didn't choose.
There's so much I disagree with there.
Really?
Yeah, okay. But let's say that is true.
Yeah.
You're keeping him there so he doesn't do it to someone else.
Yes.
So that then rape doesn't become part of someone else's narrative and then justifies another...
Totally.
...cycle of that. And if anything, it's harm reduction. To me, it's like
totally.
They cannot control it. They cannot promise that they won't do it again. Especially if they feel like, well, this is a natural expression of everything that's happened to me. Then I do think they need to be removed from society.
Yes, but
should they get help? Absolutely. Do I think we fail at that? Yeah, absolutely.
Also, he's been to jail. He gets out every 6 years. He does another offense, and he gets put right back into jail where he's fed.
Six. That's it.
Yeah, there was a whole...
I don't understand America. I don't know how he works here.
Yeah, so he didn't... So that's what happens, that he goes out. Whereas if you're in a... Even if you are in a mandatory recovery program,
yeah.
Right? Where you're monitored, you have a thing on your ankle, they know where you are at all times, and you're in recovery for 6 years, and then you get released, that makes way more sense than saying you've led a bad life, so you get put here and you have to hold still in this pen. There's something about that that is perpetuates. It's almost like when you are like, if I put a giant red button on the table and I said, if you push that button, you'll die, I would start sweating because it would be so hard for me not to push the button. It's like, if I knew that if I pushed that button, somebody was going to walk me around for 6 hours and say, we need to talk to you about how you pushed that button, it was really not okay, I probably wouldn't push the button because it would be bad.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't ruin my life. But when you go, if you rape somebody, it'll ruin your life, then you start getting the ideas of, do I want to rape? I do want to rape. It's really bad to rape. Maybe I'm bad. I think I am bad. I've been told my whole life I'm bad. I'm bad. And you hit the button, as opposed to, man, I'm going to have a lot of homework if I hit that button.
So you just think the punishment should look different.
Totally.
That's your argument.
Yeah, the punishment.
You should be punished by having to talk to therapists.
Yeah.
Doing group therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Journaling every day. Journaling.
Wow.
Journaling.
Okay, punishment is where we have different understandings of what punishment
I
means.
Think,
yeah.
I think punishment is worthy, and I think imprisonment is inhumane. Imprisonment is I think we're going to look back on it and be like, oops, that went on a little too long. You know?
I think, I understand what you're saying. I have no passionate position.
I definitely have a passionate position.
You're very
I've been to jail a lot.
Okay. See, I haven't.
Yeah.
I'd like to never go there.
It feels really weird because you're a kid and you steal, like, I stole a bottle of liquor and then somebody puts you in a cell and you're like, there's gotta be a way that I can explain what happened. Like,
what happened?
I was with a kid and he was like, do this, and I wanted to be cool and I didn't have any money, and yeah, and I stole and I got put in this jail, and I was across the country and I couldn't talk to my mom, and it was like there was no humanity. It was just like keys locked, and it was in there, and it made me be like, oh my God, if somebody were doing this for life, I mean, it's like the most horrifying.
How long were you there?
I was there for 2 days.
Was that traumatic for you?
No. It wasn't traumatic for me. It was very funny. I thought it was very funny because I was having a lot of intrusive thoughts at the time that I was going to, in confined spaces, hurt myself or hurt somebody else with my OCD. And then I got put in jail. And it was like a cosmic, like I was like, well, what am I going to hurt? One of these giant bitches that are going to kill me? No, I'm going to sit quietly on my butt.
Not make eye contact.
Yeah. But there's been a lot of, but yeah, if you know, in grade school, I would always go to the detention, and they'd throw me in the detention, and I would get out, and I would do it again. I went to an alternative middle school, high school, mm-hmm. where if you did something bad, you had to write a paper about what you did. If you disrespected a teacher, you'd have to write, and I just stopped being a horrible kid, because it was like, first of all, I'm learning something, I have to.
Yeah.
And I hate that, but yeah, it is.
I mean, I'm not against helping people and stopping cycles of trauma and all, but I just, it's not part of the system yet. And I'm not really sure how else you reduce the harm the person can do if you leave them in society.
Yes, I don't think you should leave them in society. I think you should create an alternative society for people who need to be reintroduced in society, which is done in other places. But what I was saying about the existentialism is that no free will is that it's the same, it's like, say I'm like, well, I'm just this person, right? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden in existential therapy, it unlocks that I think I'm that person because of all of these things that happened, right? That now opens up a new channel of my, like it wasn't up to me to decide to go into therapy, but I did go into therapy, which then changed my trajectory.
Cool.
Which then, so it's all this like semantic thing that people argue over, but really what it is like, comes down to like think of an animal, right?
Okay.
You think of an animal?
Yeah.
You didn't choose it. It came into your head. You did not look through a catalog in your mind. It popped up.
What if I went through several animals and was like, I'm choosing this one for her and for this question?
It still wouldn't be your choice. You would have chose a dog and an elephant and a cat because you saw them recently or whatever it was.
We talked about an elephant and a cat and a monkey and a whatever. Yeah.
Right.
Sure.
So that's not really up to you. So it's like, if you unlock the reasons for why you behave, then sure, I think you have more of the choices to choose from that aren't yours.
Sure, but I think thoughts and behaviors are a little different.
Thought and behavior.
So like, okay, maybe a thought popped into my head, and that is not something I could have controlled.
Yeah.
Right? You said what animal? I thought of a, I don't even know, a cow actually is what I thought of.
Interesting.
Yeah, random. But in my head I was like, oh, a cat. Then I was like, maybe it should be a cat. I was like, no, everyone does a cat. No, maybe I should. And like, I was selecting what animal I should select for.
Right.
But the first one went, it was a cat. Great.
Yeah.
For some reason. That you can't control if it's like a stimuli and a response. But I can now, that does not translate into you slap me, I slap you back.
Right, but it does, you slap me if I slap you back, if you haven't put a response gap in. So if I go outside and I go up to a homeless man, and I say, can you please stop shaking your shit in my face? You have poop in your hands, please stop shaking it. And he punches me. He's not going to have... Right, he doesn't have the choice to be like, I understand what's going on here, I'm recognizing that I'm shaking poop in a woman's face. You know what I mean? Like, there is no world in which he has the choice to not shake the poop in my face. Everything has led him to a man who's currently shaking poop in my face.
Sure. Sense. You're also choosing a pretty extreme example.
Yes.
But let's say the two of us, I think you have probably more freedom over reactions than you think you do.
Yes.
So I think anyone who is an adult has to practice impulse control.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, if you don't, you're going to have a really tough time, and people struggle with different impulses, but we all as adults have to control impulse control. You can't just yell at your boss because they said something inappropriate. You can't have sex with your partner just because you feel like it, even if they don't want to do it. You can't, like, there are so many things that we know we shouldn't be doing.
Right. I think it's all semantic. I think basically if you lead yourself to get to the point where you're in psychotherapy to manage impulse control, my take is it was not your decision to get there. It was...
Yeah, let's say that it's all semantics. Let's say that it doesn't actually matter if you have free will or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Hypothetically. There's no difference. I think the difference is in the mindset you will have if you believe one over the other. So one, you're kind of a victim to life. You're less responsible. And you're not as engaged. Like, you're kind of a participant, but you're also just watching things kind of unfold.
Yes.
The other one, even if it's false, makes you feel empowered, in control, responsible, autonomous, free.
Yeah, that's Daniel Dennett's take, which I do understand. But I also think that if you're witnessing yourself, like, say I have the cake and the salad.
Yes.
That's a good example. I know I need to choose the salad. I can't have the cake. If I choose the cake, if I know that it's not up to me which one I'm choosing, it doesn't make me choose the cake. It actually more so makes me choose the salad. Because the person that I am determined to be...
Yeah.
Is the person who's going to choose the healthy thing.
But that's very existential. It's like, who do I want to become? Now I'm going to make that choice.
Exactly. Totally. Sure. So I think it actually does allow there to be a freedom. Like, if I get on stage, I'm like, it's not up to me if this goes well or not. It's not. I'm going to do my best, because that's what I do.
Right. But you can't fully control it.
Okay. Right. So then I think that knowing that I can't control it allows me to lean back on the intuition of what you're talking about, where you're like, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know this room wants these jokes, or you know you want the salad, or you know he's not good for you. Being like, I'm going to rest back on my, on that I don't have agency, and that my, everything that is Jordan, that has culminated in Jordan. Like, here's a good example. I was 23. No, I was 21 or something. Mm-hmm. I had just started reading Nietzsche. My brain was, like, getting crazy. Mm-hmm. I was into synchronicity. I was, like, losing my mind. I take acid. I also am crippled with obsessive compulsive disorder. I can't touch anything. I can't touch my fridge in my house. Everything's contaminated. Mm-hmm. I have to jump skip over things in my house. And I took the acid thinking it would be like it was in high school, but I had started studying existentialism. So it started getting weird. And I was like...
A little dark.
It got really dark, and it got really, like, I can't figure out how people become bad. Like, why am I not somebody who hurts other people? Why am I not somebody who's killing myself right now? Why am I not? And I spent 6 hours in a room, and I came out, and I was like, oh, it's because everything that I've been choosing, mm-hmm. I've been doing, like, each choice that is up to me, mm-hmm. that isn't really up to me, like, as things arise, like, are you going to this? I have leaned towards something that is Jordan, right? Like, mm-hmm. I've been like, Jordan wants the salad. Mm-hmm. Jordan. And I was able to be like, oh, that arc of a human being that has been kind of ticking towards where I am has not led me to be somebody who's going to hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. And say I did. Say I all of a sudden hurt somebody. Then I would be able to go, I have crippling OCD and I had a really bad intrusive thought. And people would go, we get it. Let's get you on more Prozac. Right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to, it doesn't, the trajectory of my existence is not up to me, but the moments in which I can choose what is aligned with me and not aligned with me, I think those are up to you. The very small choices.
But that could even fall within existentialism.
Yeah.
Again, you can say, I'm someone who has really great limitations. I have OCD. I have a family that, whatever, we can make things up. But, and so now I feel like I actually am very limited. And so within this huge limit, I have a bit of freedom, and that's my playground.
Yeah.
And that's what you're describing. But that's also the position of existentialism.
Right.
To an extent. It's like, you will always be free. Viktor Frankl talked about that. He's like, the last of human freedoms is your attitude. But he wrote this in a concentration camp.
Yeah.
He's like, you will always be free. That's mind-blowing that that's where he decided to write that. Do you know that that's what emerged from being in a concentration camp? He, out of anyone, could have been like, whatever I do going forward is a consequence of what just happened to me and the fact my family died and the fact that, you know, I survived this horrendous thing.
Yeah.
And he didn't. The free will component, if anything, I feel like is something he really believed in. Not that, you know, he's not alive, I can't ask him. Yeah. But in his work, it seems really, really salient.
Yeah.
After having almost no freedom at all.
It feels a little quantum physics-y because it's also like, I think what free will would say is that Frankl was going to be Frankl no matter what happened. He chose sure. Frankl. So I do think that it is a quantum physics-y thing where it's like we're discussing quantum physics as if it's physics, which doesn't work. Because it doesn't work.
But I think it's about you as a human being. Why would you choose to believe?
We can
debate now, is it true, is it not true, and we might never know.
Yeah.
But for me, it's like, why would you be comfortable or choose to believe there's no free will, and why are you comfortable and are choosing to believe there is?
Because of the discomfort of regret mm-hmm. of not choosing the things, because of the discomfort in the moment it's a forgiveness that is almost a lazy forgiveness in order to take it on. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's lazy, but it is like to carry around the idea with you is, it's like trying to hold on to the lucid reality that not everything is in your control, mm-hmm. right? But I think and it's way more overwhelming to get on stage and be like, I could have written a set out. I could have done all of these things. I actually could have gotten more sleep. I could have whatever eaten before I got on stage.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is why existentialists go a bit crazy, because you're like, the options are limitless. And the choice is vast, and there's no right and there's no wrong. It just is. And everything that is a co-creation between me and the world.
Right.
What a crazy way to encounter the world. So I understand how tedious it is.
It's tedious.
It's very tedious, but it's so empowering. And maybe it's all an illusion and you're actually not free at all. But you're living this really cool life where you think you're, you know, driving the car.
Yeah.
You're in charge. And I think that places a bit more responsibility. I think responsibility is a great way to live the life you want.
Yeah.
No, people who don't take responsibility generally don't end up living the life that they want. And so for me, I would rather choose that illusion than the other one.
Did something switch in you where you felt, really?
I mean, I feel like responsibility changed my life.
Really? Because you were stuck in a marriage and then...
Yeah, I like hated my life. I think like in my early 20s, I was like the poster child of like the perfect child. Like I was
really
academic, I was an overachiever, you know, cute, married, helping her community, family. Like it's just like I did it all, right? Yeah. And that was kind of the outside perception. I was like, she's checking out the marks, and really quickly too. And I hated myself and I hated my life, and nothing about it felt authentic.
Oh, wow.
The only thing that remained was my love for psych. I let go of my marriage. I let go of most of my friendship at the time. I let go of perceptions of who I thought I needed to be and who I was. I set my life on fire. And I'm not suggesting everyone needs to do that, but for me it was a full deconstruction in order to construct, because, I mean, we can get into, like, the war trauma as a child and how that contributed to constructing a life I didn't want, and it came from, like, this self-protective space where it was about self-preservation. It wasn't about self-expression or self-awareness. I was just like, I need to be safe and I need to not be a burden to my parents. They've gone through so much.
Yeah.
We're immigrants. It's a very immigrant-y type thing to do and work really hard and just, you know, make them proud. And so I did that. And I then realized that I didn't actually take responsibility for my life. I did as people expected me to do, what I thought would make others happy, but I wasn't responsible for myself. I wasn't responsible for the life I was living. It wasn't mine, and I always associate responsibility with ownership. And so I came to the point where I'm like, I have to be responsible for my own happiness, for the way I
am. Because you knew you weren't happy.
I knew, and that, like, I literally was in a whiskey bar talking to a friend. I was in grad school, whatever. I knew him in college, and we were, like, so cool. No, we were so nerdy. We were, like, reading Dostoevsky mm-hmm. and like, you know, it was, he's listening to Alt J and like,
yes, and you know, that, like, we were the same. Yeah. I was doing the same shit. Yeah.
So that was the vibe.
Yeah.
We were like deep thinkers.
Yeah.
And so I saw him a couple years later and I was in grad school and married and blah, blah, blah. And we were sitting there and instead of just being like, hey, you must be so happy, you're achieving all these things, he literally just asked, are you happy? And I don't think anyone's really asked me that question before. People just imposed my happiness on me, like, hey, yeah, this is great, must be. And I just, like, lost my mind. And at that point, I was really, like, ashamed of emotions. I was not a vulnerable person. I did not cry in front of people. Like, and I just had a mental breakdown in this whiskey bar in LA, just bawling my
eyes out. Really?
One question. That was it. I couldn't even speak. He sat there fully shocked. And now we laugh. We're still friends.
Yeah.
Like, he just sat there uncomfortably staring at me because he didn't understand what just happened. And I just, like, bawled my eyes out. And I couldn't breathe. And I was like...
like a panic attack.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, I had my real panic attack, like, 2 days after that. But it was like... I was like, I can't. I rushed to the bathroom. And it's that moment of, like, looking at yourself in a mirror, yeah, and being like, I don't fucking know who you are.
Yeah.
There's a stranger looking at me. Fuck you. Like, it's your fault. And... I'm talking to her as if she's not me. I'm like, this is all your fault. And it's like, girl, like...
Because you weren't in love with your husband.
No, I wasn't. Wow. Yeah. You know, yeah, no, I really, truly wasn't. And I think in that moment, it was like, you allowed yourself to be in this weird performative state and live your life for other people. And
could you feel the, like, could you feel the performance level versus the actual...
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, the...
And I think I just, like, suppressed it whenever he came up. I was like, shh, shh.
Yeah.
And I think this was the first moment where it was, like, rage. Like, that...
Oh!
That came out and it was like, fuck you, Sarah. Like, I cannot believe this is your life. And then I, like, went back out. I was like, sweet. Wiped my tears, was like, so sorry, that was so awkward. Walked out, went to my hotel room, ordered a burrito and watched Friends. And was like, phew, did it. Like, I was like, I got over it, that was such a moment. Like, I'm gonna learn from, like, completely still ignoring what just happened.
and then what happened?
And then I, the next... I actually don't know the timeline exactly, but in a couple days I was going, because I was in LA and went to Vegas with my sister on like a girls trip, and we were about to fly home to my life. And I think just being away from my life gave me so much like freedom and relief that the thought of going back, like as I was packing, I was like, oh, I don't feel good. I was just like, I felt so heavy. I was like, my chest was kind of hurting. I was like, man, I was like, wow, I miss really not want to go back to grad school. Or like, yeah. I was just, and I was like, last night was so intense, whatever. Anyways, I'm packing. We get to the airport. I'm like kind of sweating and I'm like, I really don't feel good. I was like, maybe, you know, heat stroke, whatever.
Yeah,
like,
something, yeah.
Ate something.
And you're in grad school at this point.
I am in grad school.
For psych.
Correct.
So, okay, so the major stayed.
Huh?
The major stayed. That didn't go.
The major...
Your major that you were studying.
Oh.
That wasn't anything. You didn't blow that up.
No, I didn't blow
that
up. Sorry. No. So I was in grad school. I was seeing some clients at that time, like internship style, like just, you know, starting. And that's... I think that's the one thing that kept me sane because I was so passionate about the work.
Yeah, that's how comedy would be. I would definitely be able to feel that. I've had the mental breakdowns, and I'm like, well, that, of course.
Yeah, yeah, that, of course.
That's
yeah.
The only thing reminding me of who I am.
Whereas exactly.
Everything else, I'm like, that's not, yeah.
And even when, and you'll hear about my deterioration, but even when I was, like, in a really heavy state, when I walked into a session, it was like...
Yes.
I felt so grounded, so authentic, and, you know, as my panic attacks got worse and I took a break, obviously, just to make sure that it was ethical and I was still a student... But it was so, I was so embodied when I was in sessions and when I was with other yeah. people. And that was like, that's Sarah, you know? And when I go into sessions, even today, or when I talk about psychology or do something nerdy, like an academic conference, it's just like, it's like, this is you. Such
totally.
A cool feeling.
It's such a cool feeling.
It's such
I remember
feeling.
Crying to my mom because it was a million breakups. And I got off stage and she called me to check in.
Yeah.
And I just started crying. And I was like, I just was on stage and I had 15 minutes on stage where I just was able to escape and be myself. Like, it just was like, it's like the safe space. I was just like, here she is. Oh my God, I forgot who you were for a second. That has been crazy.
That yes. feels so good.
It's the best feeling. It's the best. It's great feeling. That we get to do it.
I work. Know.
Okay, wait, so then keep going.
I get into the plane. I get on the plane. And literally, it was like, as I was buckling up, my vision just like went blurry. And I was like, oh, I'm going to die. Like, the panic set in. And I've never had a panic attack before.
They're the worst things that anybody could ever ask.
Anyone could ever ask for. I would not wish it upon my worst enemy. Like, it is just... And I was like, I need to get off. I started yelling. I was like, I need to get off the plane. So,
oh, wow.
It's all like...
It feels, for those of you who don't know,
yeah.
panic attack is if you accidentally got too high on a lot of weed. Like, where you're like, I'm fainting. I'm worried at what I'm going to do.
I've never smoked weed. I legit don't know.
Oh, it's like, that's the only way I can describe it, is that when you're like, somebody's like, you take an edible and somebody's like, that was 100 milligrams. And you're like,
yeah.
you're sweating and you want to faint. So you stop. You're,
yeah.
you can't slow your thoughts down.
No.
And everybody's talking to you and their voices are like, and you're like, dude, slow down. And they're like, I'm talking slowly. It's crazy.
It's crazy. You're sweating. Your heart is pounding. I thought like, and you're just like, where's the nearest hospital? That was always the thing for me. Where's the hospital? I couldn't really take elevators. So I was like, where are the stairs? Like, where's the stairs?
Yeah.
Where's the nearest exit? I just like, oh my God. So I was like, get me off the flight. And luckily we didn't leave the gate yet, so I could get off the flight. And I don't even remember how I did it. I think my sister must have taken my carry-on. Like, I just walked off, like, shoving people and just, like, walking off. Then I sat at the gate, and I went and started to go into paralysis. Now, at this point, I thought I was having a stroke. My sister's on the phone with my friend, who's a doctor, and my hands did this. But, like this, and there were claws, and she would try to, like... She couldn't. They were like rocks. My muscles just cramped. And then I couldn't move my arms. I couldn't move my legs. And eventually I couldn't move my jaw or my mouth. So I stopped being able to speak. And so she's watching this unfold. Has no idea what's happening. She's running around to get like paramedics there. They come. And they're like, oh, they're so casually drove me crazy because I was like, I'm dying. They're like, oh, yeah, you're just having a panic attack, girl. And so they gave me, like, a really severe panic attack, but they gave me, like, a bag to blow in. They gave me a pill.
Okay, good thing.
And 20 minutes later, they're like, you'll be right. Like, just,
and you were?
Because they see it so much. No, I mean, I cycled. So I would have, like, because panic attacks traditionally last, I don't know, 20 to 25 minutes. And then I would have, like, a minute off, and then I would start all over again. So it would last, like, hours. That's what it felt like.
Wow.
Anyways, it was super intense. I couldn't fly back. They kept pushing my flight, and I just couldn't fathom going on a plane.
Because
it was so small. And so I ended up having to drive from California back to Canada.
Panicking, pausing.
Oh, yeah, getting off the highway. Like, I wasn't the one driving. And just, like, wanting to die. And it was so interesting because I would get out of the car because I needed to get out of the car. But to do what? Do you know what I mean? That I'm, like, standing there on the highway and it's like... Anyways, got home and then the panic attacks just persisted and I had them for about a year and a half.
And all of it was, are you happy?
All of it was, are you happy? And it was just not living my life and not knowing who I was. That's why I wrote the book on self-loss, because it's what I felt. And you can't describe it to people. People think you're being dramatic or don't really understand the suffering that comes with something like that. And so it took me a really long time. And back to the original question, which is like, the reason I'm so passionate about responsibility is because it's the one thing that made me feel like I took ownership of my life and I actually changed my life. And so for me,
how long did it take you to start altering things?
God. Forever. I was in therapy for about a year and a half, maybe two. And even when I like cut out friendships and relationships and left, I still, the panic attack stayed. And I was like, I don't understand what else I'm meant to do. Like, it was so frustrating. And that's, you know, it took a long time because I needed to start kind of restructuring myself. Like, I decluttered, which was great, but now you just have space.
So do you think panic attacks are indicative of self-deception?
I mean, they can... It depends.
For me,
it was. It was self-deception. It was a messenger. I think now looking back, I'm like, I had so many physical, like, signs that things weren't okay.
Yeah.
And I ignored it. I had so many emotions come up for me that were like indications that things weren't okay. And I ignored it. And I think this was my body being like, you're going home. You're not going to change anything. You're so oblivious.
You're going back into your life.
You're going back into your life. You're going to die there. And I'm not going to let you. And I think it was a very loving thing he did.
Yeah.
But at first I was really scared of my body as a consequence. Because I was like, that bitch is ruining my life. I don't understand why it's trying to hurt me, why it's trying to harm me. Like, it really, the panic attacks did not help my relationship with my body for a long time. Now, in retrospect, I was like, it is the one thing that stopped me from full destruction.
Right. I mean, I have panic attacks, and they're usually when I'm... It's usually when something's going on that I am tamping down. Like, usually if something happens that's traumatic, and I'm not fully processing it, and I'm trying to be strong, then I'll have panic attacks. And it is... I mean, it usually does come with a breakup or something. That... One of them died, but we have that camera. I think that one's still going.
Yeah, I think that one died.
Okay, great. But yeah, it usually comes with... It's not so much self-deception, but it's like, I am not being, it is self-deception, because I'm not being like, this is incredibly painful, that what I'm experiencing. Like, when my dad died, I was really just like, everybody keep laughing, everybody be cool.
Oh my god.
And then I was like,
when
started
did
to have,
your dad pass away?
He died 10 years ago, when I was 23, so yeah, about 10 years ago.
Wow.
But I had just started comedy, so I was like, just be cool. And then it would hit me, and it would be these weird panic attacks or breakup panic attacks. And yeah, I think it's, you know, or they would happen at times where you'd be like, it's because of caffeine, it's because of the stage, it's because of, and they'd be like, luckily my friends were like, let's slow your roll here. I was going to move to New York and just keep doing it. And they're like, no. But it is, I do think that it is, I mean, your brain is trying to, it feels like, at least when I'm in it, that, because people will talk about it in the sense of, like, you know, you're going through withdrawal. And I'm like, that, I know the withdrawal feeling, the withdrawal from love can lead to a panic attack. But there's also, but that feels more like this deep, deep low. Whereas the panic attack, when you're like, I'm about to pass out, is when you haven't calibrated your brain to reality. So, like, say all of a sudden I'm on the road with a big comic or something, and I just am like, oh, I'm panicking. It's like, it's not because of the performance. It's because I haven't calibrated that now I am this person. You know? So, like, the quantum jump you made where you're like, oh, I'm not this. I've lived a life. You can't reconcile the changes that would need to have to be made with that. Which probably aren't as substantial as the fear is, right?
Like, for sure. But it's disorienting.
It's disorienting, yeah.
And it's threatening in terms of threatening of your identity, of who you understood yourself to be, the, like, 5 minutes before.
Yeah.
And so it is responding to a real threat. It's also responding to the fact that, at least to me, it's like a messenger. It's like you've suppressed it for so long, and you're suffering because of it. It has to come to your consciousness.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But it feels like you're like, I can't imagine. When you're in it, you're like, how was I that person? How have I made all these decisions when I feel so differently now? Do you ever felt that way where you're like...
Oh, it's like, I don't even understand that girl. It's like, who is that? I don't understand.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's the feeling, but it's just like, what?
What? Yeah, how did... Yeah, I had that, there was these weird fans recently, and I had this, like, meltdown where I was like, I have to quit my other podcast, I have to quit everything I have to do. Like, how am I this person? How have I gotten to this place where... And I realized, I was like, oh, I'm just, that, you know, I'm making this jump that I don't want to be, that I don't want to cultivate this particular fan group that's been happening. Or I want to have more intellectual conversations and less fart podcasts, you know? And then I recalibrated and I was like, okay, you can do both. You can actually have an intellectual conversation on your other podcast and then fart at the end of it. And that's totally fine. And you can be a person who does that. But it's like, in that moment where you're like, oh, everything I've done is not who I am now.
Oh, I know.
That's
crazy.
But
we generalize. Like, we're very all or nothing. It's like, this little thing doesn't work. That means everything I've built up to now is like, why am I even a comic? Why am I even a therapist? Like, it's it's so irrational, but I just think it's because most of us have, like, the thinking error or the cognitive distortion of, like, all or nothing.
All or nothing, yeah.
And that's just not true. And that's why when people are like, I need to fully change, it's like, well, let's talk about what doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because chances are there's a lot that works that allowed you to be here today.
Yeah.
And maybe you're not aware of it. Maybe you don't accept that part of you. But it's not like we need to start fully over. That's...
Why are we all or nothing? Is that a... What are we at? Why... Is that like a biological... It feels like all the time it's all or nothing. Like, yeah. There's no...
I think it's also... I mean, I make humans sound so great. I think part of it is easier.
It is easier.
You're like, fuck it. Okay, let's start. Clean slate. It's like this, like...
Ooh, the clean slate. We love a clean slate.
We love a clean slate. I don't think a clean slate exists. I don't think that's a thing.
Right.
Like, in what context can that be a thing? You can't restart your relationships and pretend you didn't break up. You can't pretend... Like, there is no clean slate. Even as a therapist, it's like, there's a lot that believe, as a therapist, you're a clean slate. I believe that, as a therapist, you have your own experiences that will... shape how you understand your clients, and so you shouldn't impose them.
Right.
You need to be really, really freaking aware of them so that you can bracket them. You can go, oh, this is my stuff.
Right. Your let me just quickly, your theory, which is actually really good, is I mean,
you can say that again.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah,
love
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Is if you know how, if you can identify how you got to where you're at,
mm-hmm.
that is the closest to a clean slate you can get.
Yeah. If you, yes, and if you know exactly what's happening for you all the time and you know how to contain that while in a relationship with the world or with someone else, that's as clean of a slate you can offer someone.
Right. Is a relationship to... Is a lucid understanding of who you are.
Yeah, and not allowing that to bleed into something that it shouldn't. So it's like, this is my stuff. And I think that's something therapists are very good at, is like, okay, I, for example, don't expect all my clients to have an existential worldview or even know what it is, or even maybe they want to believe in no free will. And that's totally okay. We're going to work with whatever they want to believe. But I think it's so important for me to know what I believe so... intimately that I don't accidentally impose it on anyone. And
okay.
that same in relationships, like, I need to know what's going on for me. I need to know, like, how I'm feeling, what I'm doing, how I'm positioning my head, what my triggers are, whatever, so that then I don't project them on someone else. I go, that's my stuff.
Yeah. Man, you must have to be really well fed.
All the time.
All the time.
I get hangry all the time.
You must just have to go into every session and be
snacks.
Like... Man, because I'm even just a little hungry. It's game over.
Oh, I can't. My friends all have, like, little snacks in their bags. Or they're like, Sarah has about a 20-minute window. If she tells you she's hungry, you can't be like, okay, we'll have a reservation, like, an hour and a half. It's like, no. She must be fed. I become foul.
Yeah. Totally. So knowing yourself also means maintaining yourself, which is hard. All of it is hard.
It's tedious.
It's tedious.
But what
it's
else
like,
are you going to do with your life?
It's a very good point. It's,
like,
I have a personal trainer and I have to put all my food into my fitness pal and I want to kill myself.
That, my fitness trainer made
me
do that too. This was like 3 years ago and I was like, bro, I can't.
It's so hard. But that's kind of what all this is.
But I also don't like the obsessiveness that comes with that. Where like, I ate 3 months. It was very unhealthy for my mental health. So I told him, I was like, I can't. I'll do it for like 3 days. You'll get a general idea of how I eat. And then I'm going to stop because I don't want to count calories.
But you're kind of counting the calories... Of
I am.
Existence.
I am, but that is delicious. I'm okay.
That's
with
delicious.
That. Yeah.
Right. You're watching. Are you ever too aware of what you're doing?
I mean,
like, are you ever taken away in a moment without thinking to yourself, "I'm being taken away in a moment right now"? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
I wouldn't say I was always too aware. I mean, I hashtag goals, but no.
Yeah.
I mean, like. And sometimes I do, I think there's escapism where it's like, I don't want to think, I don't, and I think it's why people are shocked that I love reality TV.
Oh,
love it. Oh my
too.
God. Just like, Love
Candy.
Is Blind, clearly it's not. I love it. The fact we need 8 seasons to prove that, even better.
Incredible.
Let's make it 18. Like, awesome. Right, the only people that it works out is when they accidentally pick a hot partner that they like.
Right.
That's the only time it works.
It's the only time it works. So true.
And it's like, that's been, I could have told them that without producing the show. And I love it. And I just love reality TV because it's like reality, but it's not. And my brain just shuts off and everyone gets really invested and annoyed and angry. And I'm just like, this is humanity. And also some creative editing.
And the way that they're talking is so stupid. Like, it's so just like, every time I'm watching The Bachelor, they'll say something and they'll be like, yeah, well, my disability is, what did she say? It was crazy to me. She has endometriosis, so I don't know if you'd love me for that. And he was like, thank you so much for sharing that. And I was like, these people are so stupid that it's making me lobotomize, which feels good.
It feels good, but that's what I think. It shuts off my frontal lobe completely. And I think that's my way of disengaging. Like, that's my break, because I do find that I'm very analytical about everything, and I observe people, and, you know, it comes with the job, and also I just am nerdy, and I love it. And TV, for me, is, like, the thing that really calms me down and makes me fully disconnect, which, if you're someone who is struggling to connect with yourself, maybe watch less TV.
But I mean, I'm the same way. I feel like I'm hyper-analytical. I'm concerned about everything. I'm constantly looking at society in order to talk about it on stage. And then I watch TV.
Are you going
to
talk about us on stage?
Huh?
I'm a little scared.
No, I won't talk about us on stage.
Okay.
Maybe I will. Maybe I will.
Oh, my God.
But I don't. But then you watch TV, and the difference between me and you is you go, that's my escape. And I go, I'm a piece of shit for watching that reality show.
Wow.
And who would love me for watching it? Because I watch The Bachelor, which is a stupid girl thing to do. And I'm watching it.
It's oh, like it like attacks your sense of identity. You're like, this is not a cool intellectual
criteria
Brooklyn-y
collection
type thing to do.
Collection.
Is that what it is?
Totally.
Oh, no, I like own it. People know. Sarah goes to bed at 9:30. She does not party and she watches trash TV. And my attitude is always come at me. If you don't like it, I don't know. We shouldn't be friends. I don't care.
That's
like,
great.
Zero fucks given.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, we have to wrap up. Can you plug your book?
Yes. I wrote a book. It's called It's On Me. You can buy it anywhere books are sold. It's about self-loss. If you don't know who you are, why you're here, literally why I wrote the book.
Do you talk about the panic attacks then?
Yeah, it's partially autobiographical. So I walk you through my journey.
That's awesome.
Thanks.
I want to read it just because I want to
my Sure, if you told me, I would have brought you a copy.
I know. I don't know why I didn't. I wanted to get one before you got here and have you sign it.
I'm giving you a free copy. A free signed copy.
Are you doing your podcast here at all?
I was going to. I got really sick. Last week I had a flu, blah, blah, blah. I won't film it until probably fall.
Yeah. I know. I don't know when this will be released. But you should read the book.
You should read the book.
Did you do an audiobook?
I did.
You did?
I read it.
With my
voice.
That's so cool. With your own voice.
It took so long. I was so triggered. Oh my God.
Were you triggered? You're like, I hate that I wrote this. I'm getting
No, no, like I was reading my childhood war stuff and I've just never done that. I've never, like, writing it was one thing, but actually reading it, I had a full, like I cried in the studio for like 2 hours.
You triggered yourself.
Yeah. It took me like 2 hours to get through a page. And they were so sweet. The producer, the director, everyone was so nice. I, like, lost my mind.
Wow.
Granted, I was on my period. You're in the studio, like, 8 hours a day, blah, blah, blah. And they were like, Sarah, this is so traumatic. You do not need to justify. Like, I have never been more triggered by my own words.
Reading it was different than writing it. Writing it was matter of fact, trying to get it straight. And reading it was passive.
Yeah, reading it felt very embodied, like saying those words, especially because it was a childhood experience. It was just like, I only got triggered for literally 3 pages. It was really intense. I have not listened to it fully, so I have no idea what that part sounds like, but I'm pretty sure people could tell. I was like, we would do like 4 or 5 words and stop, and then I would bawl, and then 4 or 5 words and I would stop, like hours. It took hours to get through 2 pages.
That's incredible that you triggered yourself like a snake.
Yeah, exactly. Eating
its own dick
or whatever. Yes. Wow, beautiful. Yeah.
That's really crazy that you triggered yourself. Really cool.
They said it's very common for people to cry in their audiobooks, and I don't know if they're lying to me or not.
Wow. That's really cool. I mean, it means that you're writing. I feel like I would be reading it and be like, I could have done this word differently or better. But yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. You had all of that.
You had all that. Yeah. Like, when it's like the manuscript is gone, you're like, well, I could have, you know.
Right.
Then when you're reading it, you have this acceptance of this is what it is. And then you're actually experiencing it. And you're like, whew.
Wow.
Yeah. So read it, will ya?
I'm going to read it. I'm going to listen to it.
Oh no!
I'm gonna listen to it, and I'm gonna know that you were having a meltdown in every 3 minutes.
Beautiful. You tell me when. Yeah. Like it's this. It's like an hour in. No, I actually don't know what the timestamp is, but you can try to guess.
That'll be great. Right. I have clips online that were mid panic attack, so I'll share those with you. Mid panic attack, had to go on stage, panicking. And
did you tell them? You're like, I'm
panicking. I said I am.
But people think you're being funny, yep. Probably. They're like,
full panic attack. And you can hear it in my voice, like somebody yells me out. I go, please don't do that. That's freaking me out. And I'm like, and it seems funny, but I'm like, full panic attack.
People think it's like a bit.
Yeah. Or I'll panic myself. I've panicked myself by something that I've said. Like, I've been like, this happened, and then I'll see people be like, whoa. And I'm like, it is bad, isn't it? You know? Okay, cool.
Cool.
Reader book, you're the best. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. Okay, you did great. I did great.
Thanks.
We did great.
We nailed it.